This episode of the Python Perspective is sponsored by a paid political broadcast on behalf of the Wood Party. We know that you might think of the Wood Party as a bunch of old men hanging around on ropes, tumbling towards the Earth core.
We in the Wood Party feel very strongly about the present wheat drafting.
But we also on our roles have a Scotsman made entirely of wood and famed TV presenter Arthur Tree. If you feel strongly that your local government bill leaves a lot to be desired, vote Wood in your upcoming Minehead by-election, and don't let the Nationalist Bolshevist Party take control.
He's got wonderful plans for Minehead.
Like what?
Well, for a start, he wants to annex Poland.
Oh.
This advertisement is paid by the Wood Party. Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor.
Hello, Ben. How are you today?
Happy New Year, Nathan! How's 1970 treating you?
It's a whole new decade. I'm feeling like a whole new person. Seeing as how I wasn't born yet, I feel very, very non-existent.
New. Somebody in early October, late September said something along the lines of, yeah, these are the last 3 months of the decade, and my mind got blown. I'm already having enough of a trouble when people are like, oh, well, you know, back in the 90s, and that was almost 25 years ago, though that math is really creeping up on me. So yeah, welcome to a new decade. We finally get to be able to refer to something as the tease. It's the 2020s now. We didn't, you know, the 20-teens, the 20-aughts, those are decades that in the 20th century, we also were like, you know, what do you call those? You can say the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, but you never really had a good term for the first two decades. So now we're squarely out of that phrase and are able to call things by names again.
We are no longer in the teens. I feel like we've matured as a calendar viewing public.
We take things more seriously now. Like climate change. No, wait.
Fine.
Speaking of not taking things seriously, let's talk about episode 12 of Monty Python's Flying Circus, The Naked Ant, broadcast 50 years ago today on the 4th of January, 1970, having been recorded a couple weeks earlier on the 12th of December, 1969. Mm-hmm. The Naked Ant. Are there any ants in this episode?
None that I could see.
So we've had the ant in introduction with no ants in the episode. We've had the naked ant with no ants in this episode. We had a fair amount of nudity in the previous episode, but not so much in this one. I'm beginning to think that these titles are not representative or helpful at all.
It may have been they just slapped it on right at the end.
What can we do? What am I saying? Why am I sitting in this chair? Why am I on this program? And what am I going to say next?
Entirely possible. I will point out that when we did the bookshop sketch, that on the wall of the bookshop was a poster for The Naked Ape, which I believe I referred to in my intro to that episode. It was a reference that was contemporary at the time, and it feels like it could be potentially what they're referring to. It's just the ant thing is weird, that they're referring to ants now twice in episode titles. Because these were no longer the production titles of the episodes, they seem to have been added on afterwards, the question becomes, by whom and when? Were these created for the DVD or VHS releases in 1989? You know, when did they start becoming the names of the episodes in what manner is something I have not been able to put my hands on.
Didn't you say something last time about when it became time to sort of serialize the episode and distribute it for audiences around the world, it became helpful to have chapter titles just so people knew what chapter was what, and it was easier to refer to them by a verbal name versus just a episode 1, episode 5, that kind of thing?
It's definitely the sort of thing that happens with repeats and reruns, that if you're going to see that a show is on repeat in your listings, so in the Radio Times, in America, in TV Guide, the ability to look at the title of an episode and know which one it is. This, of course, is the process that Friends used by having every episode be called the one where or the one with. And then after that, it would be like when Mr. Eccles dies or when the cat explodes, or I didn't watch very much Friends. But that's the idea, is that it gives you a quick, pithy summary of what you might be able to, you'd be able to remember, oh, I've seen this one, I want to see it again. Whereas The Naked Ant, not being representative of what happens in the episode, isn't useful in that regard. Whereas the one where Chandler gets his head stuck in a water cooler, people are going to remember that one.
Friends, of course, is a narrative sitcom where Monty Python is not. So it'd be harder to kind of compartmentalize all of the sketches into one under one banner, I think.
Also very true. Even in episodes where you have a large, overwhelming theme for most of the show, for example, episode 7, You're No Fun Anymore, where literally 50% of the episode is the science fiction sketch of men turning into Scotsmen, the title doesn't have anything to do with the majority of the episode. So even when we had themed collections of sketches in a given episode, the title wasn't reflective of that.
Sure.
And in fact, this episode opens with a man in a train control box being attacked by an ape.
I know you, dang it!
In a particularly non-sequitur sort of thing. I mean, in terms of, in the last episode, we talked about how there were good interwoven, interleavened moments of the sketches leading one into another. This is a set and a costume that basically don't repeat. There are two quick little moments that where they reappear.
I think it might be a bear.
Yes. What did I say? Ape?
You said an ape. You had naked ape in your conscience.
I think that is entirely accurate. Yes, a bear. The production notes actually state that the Pythons had requested a polar bear costume, but there's no follow-up as to why they ended up with a brown grizzly bear, something that almost doesn't really look like a bear, just look like a walking throw rug with a man inside it. When you have the close-up at the very end of the episode during the montage of different people saying no, you really get a good close look at his nose and teeth. And I suppose it's nominally bear-like, but only barely.
No.
No.
No!
Swear to you, that whole thing wasn't just a setup for that joke.
Bear and bear, they sound the same, but mean totally different things.
Good callback.
I'll bring it up when I talk about my favorite sketches.
Okay.
In fact, let's just go there. I do have other things I want to say, but I will put that on pause. Favorite sketch number one, Spectrum, talking about things.
What are the figures? What are the facts? What do people mean when they talk about things?
So this is one of your three favorite sketches of the episode. I'm interested in that, particularly because I think I was going to mention that this sketch seems like the kind of thing that I would like, and yet somehow it rings hollow for me. Unfortunately, I feel like the sketch was done better many, many years later by Fry and Laurie on a bit of Fry and Laurie in their sketch called We're Talking About Language. And it's not fair to compare something that is largely derivative of Monty Python's Flying Circus to taking an idea and improving on it. But I'm interested that this might be one of your three favorite sketches, and I have a couple theories on that. So why don't you talk first?
In this episode, they have introduced a new way of reaping humor from language itself. We've seen Idle do a high volume, like a high quantity of words, which is funny because it keeps on going on and on and on. And you also see that with other sketches like Johann Gimbleputty, the long, long name. But we also have the incoherence of language, which we saw in the Agatha Christie sketch in the previous episode. Mm-hmm. But I think as of this episode, we hadn't seen the speed of delivery as a way of mining humor from language. And what I liked about Palin's delivery is just how quick it is.
So where do we stand? Where do we stand? Where do we sit? Where do we come? Where do we go? What do we do? What do we say? What do we eat? What do we drink? What do we think? What do we?
It almost likens it to a train kind of going off the rails, literally. It cuts into film with a train basically crashing because it's going so fast.
Right.
So I find the pace of delivery, less so the actual content, is what makes it funny for me. Now, we've talked about speed and the heightened sped up footage being funny on film, but I like how the sped up delivery, the high pace of delivery, that is actually funny too. So it's a new way of introducing humor.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I wish that there were, like in the Cleese sketch in the previous episode, where he's tumbling over the words and intermixing them in some way and stumbling over them. The combinations of words are clever and interesting. They're ordinary words, but you can feel a really good editor's knife in the way in which that they're recombined together. So when we have Palin saying, frothing and falling, calling,
calling, screaming and bawling, walling and stalling, galling and mauling, bawling and hauling, trawling and squalling and zawling.
It's much more that he's just taken the sound and runs through the alphabet and slams a bunch of consonants in front of it. It doesn't feel like he's doing anything, particularly in the performance of the presenter, that he's going mad or that he's falling down a rabbit hole of his own brain. It's just that he's doing a list form of sound-alikes that leads him to confusion about the nature of words. There's a marvelous bit in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead by Tom Stoppard, where you have a character say, have you ever had that experience where you write down a perfectly ordinary word, but you can never recall having seen the letters in that order before? Which to me is a genuine experience. It's something where I will ever so often write a word and just stare at it and be like, wait, that can't be how that's spelled. That's just wrong. How have I never noticed how weird that word looks before? Where you have this dissonance of the fact that language is constructed and artificial and that we take it for granted so often, and then every so often the veil is ripped off like a Band-Aid and we're just like, no, that language doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense. And so I would love it, or would have loved it more, if there was something anxious or desperate or existential in Palin's delivery instead of just speed. To cast forward, because I see you thinking about this, I would say, think about the deja vu sketch that comes up. And you have Palin when he's trapped in the time loop of talking about deja vu and then unable to complete what's going on. He gets more and more disturbed by the awareness of the fact that he's done this before. He's experiencing the deja vu and it's rocking him to his core. And he gets really flustered and sweaty and anxious. I would perhaps have enjoyed this sketch more if there was something built in there where his dissatisfaction with not knowing what he means when he says means or word, and what do words mean and what are words words, if that was part of an anxiety instead of just a torrent, there might have been something in there that I could have clicked with.
I think this sketch catches the viewer a little off guard, where we are expecting something a little more zany, perhaps, or a little more punchline-y. But there really is not.
Right.
So it's really the anticipation of a joke which kind of like draws us in a little more. If he had read this at 1x speed, it would get dull and boring. But since he's going so fast, we kind of was like, okay, when is a joke happening? And the longer he traipses along without having anything verbally funny come out of his mouth is what makes it enjoyable for me, is the anticipation of a joke. So for me, I don't need that sense of freneticism.
You don't need it to ratchet up.
I don't need that as a justification for it being on my top three.
Excellent.
So it's really more the anticipation of the joke that doesn't come, which makes it enjoyable for me, because I have to kind of sit and pay attention a little more closely. I do wish that they had a little bit better lighting on the words that he holds up.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the few things we won't be able to cut to a clip of the final punchline, because it's delivered silently, where you just have to read that he's holding the sign so and there.
So that's what I would say brings this sketch home for me, is the anticipation of a joke that does not happen.
That is profoundly existentialist in its own right, to be completely honest with you.
I think that's in very bad taste.
Now, I will say, about 50% of this episode is taken up by two sketches. And so I will be very surprised if in our top three today, the other two long, significant sketches aren't the major portions of our top three. So let's see if you prove me wrong.
Okay, so number two, I think it needs to be hashed out with the details of where the sketch begins and where it ends.
Aha!
So I'm putting number two as Visitors from Coventry, is how it's listed on the Wikipedia page for this particular episode. And to me, that begins with Eric Idle and his wife coming into the hotel or bed and breakfast.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, isn't it?
That's right, yes.
Well, come on in.
And it ends at the end of when the Nazis get all crazy and start pointing guns at everybody.
Can't you ask that? You aspire something? Get out there against some old British pig, you're going to die!
Take it easy, Dickie, old chum.
I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson. He's a bit on edge. He hasn't slept since 1945.
Less so inclusive of the Hitler and Bimmler and Bon Vivintrop
rally.
Actually, the rally.
So, yeah, three portions of this overall sketch wherein Eric Idle and Gillian Phelps walk into B&B in order to meet the other neighbors, played by Connie Booth and by Terry Gilliam, and then their three compatriots, Hitler, von Ribbentrop, and Heinrich Himmler, who are all under pseudonyms, staying there as they plan to run in the local by-election in the town of Minehead. And the sketch is broken up into a series of different portions. The first is where you have Idle's character talking about, in an incredibly detailed and yet frustrating fashion to landlady Terry Jones, how much the route that they took was more complicated than it should have been.
Well, we usually reckon on 5.5 hours, and it took us 6 hours and 53 minutes with a 25-minute wait at Frampton Cottrell to stretch our legs. Only we had to wait half an hour to get on the M5 near Droit.
He just basically lists off a bunch of highways and intersections. There is one particular line in there that I very much like, where he says, you know, we could put in a third lane in there because there's 6 feet on the verge, and we just have to knock down that hospital, and then burns forward. And it takes an audience a couple of seconds to catch up with the fact of what he said. After that, after he gets cut off, we're introduced to the Nazis, and the joke in the second section is the aliases and just how badly these three Nazis are hiding in this bed and breakfast. They're in full uniform, they have aliases, which are tend to be one letter off from their actual names.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't introduce you. This is Ron. Ron Ribbentrop.
Oh, not Von Ribbentrop, eh?
9999! Oh, no, different other chap.
After which, we cut to the third section, which is a filmed section, which is a rally in the town as the National Bolshevist candidates for Minehead try to gin up support for this very thinly veiled Nazi party amongst some hayseed yokels and children.
Mr. Hitler! He said that historically, Taunton is the part of Minehead already.
He's right. Do you know that?
And then the fourth section of the sketch is a series of vox pops.
I gave him my baby to kiss, and he bit it on the head.
Well, I think he'd do a lot of good for the stock exchange.
But for you just like the bits that are in the first half of the sketch that are performed live in front of the studio audience.
I find the rallies to be a little bit long.
Okay.
And I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But I feel like the joke has already been played and it just goes on maybe a minute or so beyond where I feel I'm getting antsy for it to move on.
Okay.
I do love how they have used what I guess a German person who doesn't really understand English would speak English. Things like,
I in Somerset am being born, von Ribbentrop
Esquire. Also, I'm not Minehead lad, but I in Peter von Lincolnshire House was given birth to.
One of my favorites is that Mr. Hilter starts to greet the couple that's come in, and I believe he says, good time, and then corrects himself to say, good morning, which I don't think is actually potentially accurate. Not speaking German, I'm merely making an assumption, but I know that guten Morgen is good morning, and guten Abend, I believe, is good evening. Good Nacht is good night. So the idea that there could be literally a phrase that is good time, and but instead it seems to be more of a meta commentary on the fact that his English is so iffy that he's forgotten the construction of the actual word and just puts in the placeholder of good amount of time in which we are in before he hastily corrects himself.
Eating I am lots of chips and fish and hole in the toads and Dundee cakes on Piccadilly line. Don't you know, old chap?
I think Palin and Chapman are especially good in their, speaking of people who are playing characters who are nervous and potentially breaking down in their dialogue, both of them are so flustered and so worried about being caught that their anxiety about speaking their cover stories, the way in which famously in the film The Great Escape, a lot of shoe leather is spent on the idea of you gotta be able to answer the questions if somebody stops you at a checkpoint. You've gotta be able to convincingly impose that you belong there. And so Palin's dialogue, as you say, with the toad in the hole and the various very English types of food that he would be eating, and therefore you'll definitely believe that I am an Englisher, yes, ha ha ha, because he's littered his backstory with very English references.
And just using them in the wrong way.
Yes.
Like calling them dog hots.
Oh, can we please make that happen? If only our listening audience will go out there onto the internet and start rephrasing them as dog hots. Go to your local baseball team and please request dog hots.
One thing about the structure of this whole huge segment is it's very clearly written by a bunch of different groups. Mm. Idol starting off with his pretty impressive, consistent stream of words / ramble is that starts off a bunch of different sketches in the first series. Mm. Hilter and Bibbentrop and Bimler inside the B&B was a Michael Palin, John Cleese writing partnership.
Okay.
So we're starting to see more of the mixing up of the writing teams. I would assume that was consistent with the filmed portions as well.
I do love the filmed portions. I understand that it's an extension of the joke in a very leisurely manner, but watching it again in preparation for this episode, some of the things that struck me about it were just how ludicrous it was that these were filmed in public. It's one thing to be on a soundstage in the BBC dressed in a Nazi uniform in front of a bunch of audiences who are aware of the fact that you are recording an episode of a comedy sketch show. It is quite another thing to have gone out into public and to have hung a Nazi banner from a second floor balcony and to then ask a couple of small school children to stand there and watch you and to hand them flyers and to also ride in full getup on a bicycle past a bunch of people who are just on the street. You can see quite clearly a number of people sort of watching the bike go by and saying, "What the hell is that?" Like, they're not, their body language is 100% appropriate. Whether they were paid extras or whether they just grabbed it as what would be called guerrilla filmmaking footage these days.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, their response to it is completely appropriate, which is, "Did I just see what I thought I saw?" is exactly how anybody should have been reacting. And it is that tension between they're making a sketch, but they're doing it in the real world that I really found very energizing in terms of its comedic potential.
Alice must be there, Mr. Smith! Just stop and die!
I wonder about those three kids. Do they remember John Cleese doing one of the best Hitler impressions ever put on film, where he's got the body language, he's got the accent, he's clearly watched the Nuremberg rallies in order to be able to mimic and ape his body language in a very vivid and commanding way? Do they now be like, "My God, I just thought that was normal"? or what do they remember? I wish somebody had the ability to track them down. There doesn't seem to be, in Daryl Larson's marvelous annotations, a listing that they were paid, because otherwise their names would have been on pay sheets in the BBC records.
Mm-hmm.
So potentially, because they were shot from the back and they didn't say anything, they didn't have to give them any money. And so no records would have been kept to be able to track them down and say, "Oh, by the way, what was it like to witness the rebirth of the extreme right in England long before Brexit?"
I would congratulate Python on the professionalism of doing that filmed portion.
Mm.
It, as you say, it probably was not really a very simple thing to walk out in what probably was Minehead downtown, go up to the second floor of an apartment block and scream out Nazi fascist German. Yeah. I've done guerrilla filmmaking before, and before they call action, there's a little bit of you is like, what I could be doing right now really could get me very much hurt. Somebody just might take it wrong or get up in my face, and if I'm in character, you kind of give yourself a little bit of pause just before they yell action. So the fact that they did it with such gusto, that's a good professional working momentum.
I would also just like to briefly point out that this sketch in general presages what comes up in episode 31, which is a sketch that I referred to a number of times, so it must really be somewhere in my Python lexicon, where you have Eric Idle's character attempting to go on a holiday, but he's unable to say the letter C, and so he always replaces it with the letter B.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up turning into a legendary rant about other tourists, and includes the phrase Watney's Red Barrel a number of times. But at the beginning, it's just simply that it was an affliction that happened to him because he was bitten by a bat, to which he has inquired, do you mean cat? And he says, no, I mean bat. the confusion of the substitution of the letter B into words, which we have here with Ron Bibbentrop and Heimlich Bimler and the Nationalist Bolshevist Party.
Well, I don't like the sound of these here concentration bumps.
it is the slimmest of camouflage of the original edition of the Third Reich here in this 3.5 beta Reich. And yet, that is the joke I think that works best for me, is that anybody paying the least bit of attention would have been able to figure this out, and yet nobody seems to actually notice what's going on right underneath their noses.
Number three.
Just before we move on, just a quick question. You've done some research in the past into the career of Reginald Maudling, if I'm not mistaken.
A tiny amount.
What do you remember about him as a person? Because he tends to be referred to on the cassettes and several times in the second series as a cultural touchstone. I don't want to put you on the spot, but...
Reginald Maudling was a conservative member of parliament, at least for some portion of when Monty Python was being produced.
It's just that Larson has an interesting idea that the reason why Himmler's first name is Reginald is because it's the first reference to Reginald Maudling, despite the fact that he hasn't come up previously in the series. And the first time that he's officially referred to is in the third episode of season two on July 16th, 1970. That's the first time that the word Maudling is actually used. But there is some interesting back and forth with Bimler, in that he's introduced by Terry Jones as Heinrich Bimler, but Hilter refers to him as Reginald before that. So his cover story name seems to be Reginald Bimler, although it's unclear because he's also referred to as Heinrich. The only reason I mention this is because Larson very much wants to make a connection between the fact that Mr. Hilter's first name is Dickie to Richard Nixon. And so for one of them to be Reginald and one of them to be Richard seems to Larson to be a specific call out of these people, even when they're in hiding, are taking the names of awful people. And since Nixon does show up very briefly in the animation in the middle of the series, that seems to be the dotted line that Larson is drawing.
I think we might liken Reginald Maudling to a Mitch McConnell type character, type person.
All right, ready to move on? Sketch number three.
You could have guessed it, Ben. Number three.
The 127th Upper Class Twit of the Year show.
If you have the previous sections, the visitors, the filmed bits, and the vox pops in the Secret Nazis in Minehead section, altogether it comes to a grand total of 7 minutes and 39 seconds. And the Upper Class Twit of the Year filmed segment is 6 minutes and 41 seconds. An extraordinarily long, detailed, intricate sketch. Now, if you look at it in the scripts that were published by Pantheon many, many years ago, this is 3 solid pages of John Cleese narration, which is really quite extraordinary. And it also means that it's more than 6.5 minutes of the studio audience just watching a film, which is also quite a leap of faith. And so what I'm interested in is whether or not you think the recording of Cleese's voiceover was done so that the sketch and the voiceover were presented simultaneously as a filmed moment. Because if you look at some of the editing, it's extraordinarily complicated in terms of getting his voice to react, or whether potentially he actually did the commentary live in studio while watching the film along with the audience. Now, we're back in speculation territory here.
I think it's unlikely that he would have done it live.
Okay.
Just a feeling. If, for example, he got his timing off, or he dropped a word, or he got his lines confused, thereby necessitating a redo.
Oh, yeah.
he still would have been able to do it, but the audience would have had their laugh expectation dulled a little bit. And it doesn't seem to go down that much. But compared to what, I obviously don't know. I feel like anything which is on film and then accompanied by narration, I feel like that's all done before the audience shows up, is sort of pre-canned, and then it's just displayed as is.
It's a little interesting in that there are one or two occasions where Cleese's commentator misidentifies the twits, and he has to correct himself.
Simon's coming through quite fast on the outside, I think. Simon and Nigel, both of them coming through very fast. Oh, there's Nigel there, number three, I'm sorry.
And there's also the idea that the timing is really quite extraordinary in once you get the action going. Obviously, when you're talking about the names of the characters as they're being introduced very early on, you would need to know how much Cleese was going to say before you cut to the next one. And so that leads itself to the belief that this had to have been done with the recording, because otherwise you wouldn't have had those headshots be the correct length in order to match up with what he's saying about them, in order to say,
Nigel Incubator Jones, his best friend is a tree, and in his spare time he's a stockbroker.
You're going to need to know that that cut happens immediately after that in order to go to Gervais Brookhamster. But later, once you get into the actual action, there's a lot of filler, and the kind of writing it would take in order to know...
Now in the sports car, he's reversing into the old woman, he's going to accidentally move the thing. Now he's going to accelerate.
You know, that kind of motion, I do wish I knew whether or not it was just sort of an outline and he went into commentary mode, where he knows he has to hit these main points, but it was largely improvisational, or how it worked. Because there are a couple of moments where there's an almost flub, or cutting back to the audience in the stands isn't correctly identified. And so there is an element of inconsistency that feels like it's being done not from a strict script. And I suppose probably in the middle is someplace that actually happened.
Well, here's my take on that.
Please.
So in the start of the filmed portion, it is announced it is a fine winter day.
Okay.
And we have been doing this whole podcast kind of under the understanding that a lot of the filmed portions were filmed sometime in the summer. I have not been to England in wintertime, but my understanding is that it's not very snowy.
Mm-hmm.
In the film, it is cloudy overhead. There are no leaves in the trees. So it conceivably could be wintertime. And so the only winter that has transpired since Monty Python was being produced was probably a couple of weeks before this actually went onto the screen. So my guess is that this was filmed very late in the production cycle. Therefore, the editing happened during the studio-produced portions of the show. So the actual time Cleese had to perfect his sports commentary was not as long as it would be normally, because usually the filmed portions are edited and in the can for you to talk over back sometime in August, maybe September. So here he probably had maybe a week or two, along with other line memorization, blocking, that kind of thing to do in studio. I mean, that's just a guess, but it struck me as like, well, I thought all the filmed portions were done in the summertime, but this is perhaps in the wintertime. I can't tell. But there are indicators like no leaves in the trees, and you can see their breath when they're running around. So it's
very
cold.
Much so.
Maybe nitpicking on those details, but that's kind of my guess, is he was probably not ad-libbing it, but probably not as polished as he could be. Now, if you do watch this very same thing, which has been reshot for and now for something completely different,
right,
his timing is much more spot on.
Which is in and of itself interesting, considering that they recast the twits. That different pythons play different twits in the series. I believe three of them are in different roles, which is in and of itself a fascinating little piece of something. That there is something about their performances, the fact that they won, or what they were good at in terms of the action, that they felt, actually, Terry, you'd be better if you did this twit versus this twit, is a psychology that I don't feel comfortable delving into. But also, it means that it's shorter. It's much more tightly edited. There are a number of events in here in the Python's Flying Circus version. Walking in a straight line, jumping over matchbooks, kicking the beggar, the hunt ball photo, reversing into the old woman, waking up the neighbor, insulting the waiter, walking under the bar, shooting the rabbit, bras off the Debs, and then shooting themselves. And I believe three or four of those are cut for and now for something completely different.
Yeah. If you have a copy of the 1999 A&E DVD release for this episode, under the useless tidbits portion of this episode, you have the following quote. The idea for this sketch came from the patrons of a wine bar near John Cleese's Sloan Square home. The Sloan Rangers, as they were called, kept John up at night with their comings and goings. According to Graham Chapman, this sketch was their revenge, unquote.
Did you look things into like, Sloan Rangers?
I did not.
Okay.
Seeing as how waking the neighbor is one of the tasks that they do in both and now for something completely different and in, obviously, the episode here, that's probably where Cleese is coming from.
I could just briefly tell you that Sloan Rangers is a term for a certain kind of regional, upper-class, super-entitled party-goer and bon vivant that seems to have been coined in the UK magazine Harper's and Queen in 1975. I found all this out by following a link from looking up upper class twit of the year and finding a Wikipedia entry about the sketch itself. And at the bottom, it says related links, Sloan Rangers. I was like, that is a strange piece of slang I don't recognize. And one of the most prominent Sloans that was identified when a book version of this magazine article was eventually published in 1982 was Princess Di, or therefore, at that time, Lady Diana Spencer. And so, if you sort of think of that super refined, but also incredibly entitled behavior, that's one of the defining characteristics of the Sloans. And I did find an article from 2015 that basically said that the Sloan Ranger doesn't really exist anymore as a species in London. And a 2017 article looking back on the Sloan Ranger handbook 35 years later and sort of looking at whether or not that defining group of people exist or whether the times have changed. All of this, of course, is a little incidental in that it takes place after Python did this. And I do believe that part of what Python is specifically lampooning in this sketch is a degree of inbredness more than simply an awareness of privilege. If you look at the physicality of the way in which the twits move with their lips pulled back over their teeth. And the sort of grunty groundhog behavior, the way that they fall up their feet about like fins, and the way they aren't smart enough to walk under a beam, it really does seem that it's less about, oh, the world is my oyster, in a Bertie Wooster Drones Club idiot sort of way, and much more of a, we've been hereditary peers for such a long time that we have bred out intelligence from our very nature, and therefore, as the sketch concludes, you're really only a winner as an upper-class twit if you go on to not be able to have children because you've successfully executed yourself.
It's a pretty harsh stab.
Oh, yeah. Although, not quite as harsh as a joke that comes up in the Mr. Hilter sketch, where Hitler, as he's about to leave the room for the bed and breakfast to get on a conference with one of his subsidiaries who he thinks may have leaked information, says,
if he opens his big mouth again, it's lampshade time!
Which is one of the most disgusting jokes I've ever encountered in my life. Are you familiar with this?
I looked up the script because I couldn't tell what it was. I couldn't tell what he was saying. And the script I found in MontyPython.net said it was Leipzig. So I don't know if my reference is correct. If you have some more data, then tell me.
I'm pretty sure that this is a reference to the fact that in the Holocaust Museum in Auschwitz, there is a lampshade made out of human skin with the tattoo still on it. And it's on display in part to show just how dehumanized the Jews in camps were, that they were used as materials and experimented on as maybe we could use them as raw materials for the future, that we can turn them not into people, but into things that we use around the home. I think it's literally a joke that says, if he's disappointed me again, I'm going to turn him into a flesh lampshade, and that it's an extraordinarily violent reference to existing historical behavior. It's one of the sickest, weirdest jokes they've ever made, and it's only, I think they get away with it in part because nobody laughs. Like, it's that creepy. Either people didn't know the reference as widely as some people do now, or it was so shocking that they didn't laugh. I can't quite tell.
Hmm. I thought you were going to say it's not as cutting as the Ken Shabby sketch.
Ken Shabby.
Mr. Shabby, I just want to make sure that you'll be able to look after my daughter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'll be able to look after her, all right, sport. I know what I mean, I...
That sketch is, if upper class tweet of the year is really lambasting the upper class, Ken Shabby is definitely making fun of the working class.
Mm.
And to me, that sketch doesn't really work very well.
Interesting.
Not that we're going to talk about sketches we didn't like, but whereas upper class Twitter of the Year is comic and creative because they make essentially an Olympic sport out of it on how dumb they are and how inbred they seem, the Ken Shabby sketch is literally just telling the audience, this is how terrible a person I am. So I don't think the writing in it is as good.
Well, I'll just defend it briefly by saying I think the comic conceit is twofold. It's not just the idea that he's astonishingly filthy, disgusting person who wants to marry this English rose beauty just in order to be able to get some.
Oh, I see. And when do you expect to get married?
Oh, right away, sport, right away, you know. I haven't had it for weeks.
It's the weird way in which Chapman, as the father, like, doesn't even notice. The way in which Connie Booth continues to stroke his arm and look lovingly at him in some really quite extraordinary acting. I want to hold both her up and Gillian Phelps as being really quite good at reacting silently to what's going on. They're given very little to do, and they really knock it out of the park with their engagement and involvement on screen, despite not actually having anything to really to say or any jokes. They don't even get a "this is my only line." They just are required to watch the boys interact with each other. I think the joke is that neither one of them really hears the fact that he's laying it out on the line, just how awful he is, and they don't seem to be, like, disturbed or weirded out by it. They're just like, all right, that makes sense, that checks out. I love you anyway.
Graham does a little bit, but not as much as a real portrayal of that scene would make you believe. Okay, I'll concede that.
Well, if we've done our three sketches, unless there's anything else about the upper class quit you'd like to say.
Nope, I've already said it.
Then let us move on to the Monty Python Minute. Da-da-da-da-da! Where we take a minute of the show as determined by random number generator on random.org. And Nathan watches that minute and then provides us with some commentary as to what he's seen and then has to answer a series of trivia questions equal to that minute in order to pass on to co-hosting the next episode. Wait, no, that's not the stakes. Otherwise, this episode would be hosted by neither of us because I believe we have both failed multiple times to be able to meet the trivia. Nathan, are you ready?
Yes.
Random.org has provided us with minute number two.
Minute two, hey?
Minute two.
He's a good golfer, Wilkins.
Very good golfer, very good golfer. Rotten at finance. It'll be Parkinson next.
Right off the hot train switching box action and the titles, we zoom in on two. Are you ready to tell us what happens in a mere 30 seconds?
Sure.
Starting now.
Eric Idle, John Cleese are two guys working in an office, and outside the window, they see men falling by, and they speculate that it's another board meeting of people higher up in the company are just either committing suicide or being pushed out of the window, and they bet on who's going to go next. Is it Wilkins, Parkinson, or Johnson? Which then transfers to Graham Chapman writing a letter, and he complains about people who fall out of buildings. He's worked in a building all his life, and as
10 seconds left,
he just falls out in this pen scrawl.
5 seconds left.
And it translates to Gilliam, who turns the pallet sideways because falling down is too much graphic. Stop. And telling sideways.
Nicely done.
How can this be nice? This has got to be, it's verbal abuse for the audience.
Yeah, I think there's the distinct possibility that as we look at our iTunes stuff, that we'll be able to see that once you're talking real fast and I'm shouting over you, that that's where our listening drops off all of a sudden before the end of the episode. Yeah. Entirely possible. Thank you, Apple Metrics. But Nathan, this is minute two. Do you know that what that means in terms of how many questions you need to answer in the trivia quest section? Just two. So we have two key elements in this segment that I identified. The first of which was the ragdoll drop of the letter writer as he gets thrown out of a window and falls to his death.
Yep.
And the second is Gilliam's hand interrupting the animation. Both of these have happened before. in the previous episodes. So, I can give you the name of the sketch, and then you can identify the episode number, or I can give you the episode number, and you can attempt to tell me in what sketch that happened in that episode.
I mean, I can, off the top of my head, I can think of a few.
Tell me what you got.
Admiral somebody from the Famous Deaths.
Correct. Kiss Me, Hardy. That's from episode one.
There's some other episode where managers falling from a high building, and these are two stockbrokers falling from a high building.
It's not stockbrokers. Can you remember the profession?
Accountants, chartered accountants.
Those would be both the best obvious guesses, but unfortunately, it's encyclopedia salesmen in episode five. So let's do Gilliam interrupting the animation. In episode two, Gilliam's hand comes down and changes the course of what's going on because something has been happening and somebody says, stop it, I'm not going to allow this to happen anymore, and the hand comes down. What does the hand do?
So the cartoon is of a crotchety old man pushing a pram, and the pram is actually some kind of beast that devours women who look into it.
Correct! Nathan, you have gotten two correct answers on our two sections with three options quiz. Random.org has swept in and given you an achievable goal. Congratulations. It's almost the end of the series, Nate, and you've got a stone-cold victory. I think you should feel like this is a learning curve.
Time to move on. Listeners, this is now a five favorite moments portion of the podcast. You know very intimately is where Ben and I hash out our top five brief segments of film, studio taping, or animation, what we call a moment, that make us smile. Ben, give me a top five moment.
I say one of my favorite episodes of the moment is in the Silly Voices Policeman sketch.
Hmm.
Where when you have the beginning of explaining the conceit.
I wish to report a burglary.
Speak up, please, sir.
So you have Terry Jones in the policeman's office in the front desk, and there's a process of him figuring out how high to pitch his voice in order to say it.
Now, a little bit louder.
I wish to report a burglary!
Report a what?
And John Cleese says,
that's it! That's the exact frequency! Now keep it there!
And in general, I think this is an astonishingly good episode for Cleese. This is a real showboat thing for him. In the sketch that you just talked about, the way in which he underplays the accountant who isn't really interested in what's going on, that Eric Idle keeps on getting more and more worried and he isn't able to get a reaction out of Cleese. Cleese does an astonishingly good upper-class twit. He's really good as Hilter. And his commentary over the upper-class twit is also the exact sort of thing that we loved when he was doing it in the Picasso bicycle race. He's extraordinarily good at channeling that sports commentator delivery. And so this moment as well, where he plays the police officer behind the desk, the constable or sergeant, I believe he's a sergeant based on the number of stripes on his sleeve, that the way in which he coaches Jones into being able to get the right response, that line is, there's just something about it that makes me laugh. It's endemic of the kind of frustration that Jones is about to experience, but also the kind of frustration that must have been going on with this man his entire life if he's only able to hear people who talk like this.
My turn. Number two. We did mention already the differences we might feel about the Ken Shabby sketch.
And what job do you do?
I clean out public lavatories.
Is there a promotion involved?
Oh, yeah.
But I just love the line,
after 5 years, they give me a brush.
It's such a good moment. Because then you imagine just how much him having to clean toilets up until that point would have created Ken Shabby as the man that he is today. A pile of brown filth and a mustache.
Number three.
Moment number three, I'm going to say I mentioned this briefly, but I'm going to say the no montage at the end.
Has anyone anything else to say?
No.
Nope.
No.
It was one of the things that occurred to me to go back and watch for a couple of reasons. One is that I wanted to see how much of it was done live in the studio. So we have, leading up to that, we have Robert talking about the party political broadcast. And then it cuts to a callback with Michael Palin's character saying, what do we mean by no? What do we mean by yes? And then having the word no terminate. Those series of no's, some of them were recorded earlier and then edited in here. That couldn't have been what the audience saw, because only the second half is on film. All the previous no's were done in studio of the characters that they played over the course of that evening, which gives you an interesting idea about the editing and production of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one of the no's is inserted into the responses to the Nationalist Bolshevist Party, because all of the other reactions are favorable. You've got the accountant who thinks that they might be able to fix the Federal Reserve. You've got Bimler in disguise. You've got the racist Terry Jones, who hopes that they'll do away with people of color, but then again, she is mental. You've got basically almost everybody sort of being like, yeah, they've got some good ideas. But then you have one woman who goes, no, no. And I do feel certain that that must have been originally part of the end, but that they were like, I don't think we can actually have everybody saying, yeah, good ideas. Well done, Bolshevists. And so they needed to inject some no's in there. Anyway, I do like the collage. I like that it's a series of callbacks to everybody we've seen in the episode, including the animated animals that climbed out of the pipe. It's a lot of fun, and it's a good way of creating that kind of final feeling that the episode was cohesive, even when it was a series of sketches. What about number four for you, Nate? What's your number four moment?
You mentioned already that this is a strong episode for John Cleese. I'm going to add on to that. Literally his flaming rant in the Robert sketch.
Well, Robert, the main thing is, this is terribly exciting, tremendously exciting. You see, the minister is now quite clearly lodged between rocks that we know terribly little of. Of course, the main thing
is... It's such a curious moment. It really is odd.
It's his eyebrow is all askew, and he just talks in a very maniacal way. It's one of those high-strung characters we seem to like Cleese doing.
Mm-hmm.
His weird hair and the sort of odd overlay of footage of an actual flame. They're pretty primitive, but they work. And I think it's the eyebrow, which makes it stand out as unique to me.
Let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
When he first cuts to him and he's got his hair like that and the eyebrow and the weird way he's standing, I was pretty sure that the joke was going to be that he was also hanging upside down, like Graham Chapman had been once he fell through the Earth's crust. Do you think that he's also performing that, hanging upside down, and that they, like the Graham Chapman footage, had the camera upside down so that he looked right side up? Or do you think that he's just standing there in a weird hunch?
He had to have been standing there because they toss water on him and the water falls down.
Okay. I watched it a couple of times trying to go back and forth and going, do I just misunderstand how water works? Is this like Nate saying, sped up footage of waves is not funny. Maybe I just don't understand fluid dynamics. All right, good. Because I did spend up until they throw the water going, maybe the reason he's catching on fire isn't just that he's so uptight and weird, but also that maybe he's also closer to the Earth's core and therefore catching on fire due to proximity to magma. I wasn't sure exactly what the point of it is, but I agree with you. I think his performance is so off the wall and so interesting that it really makes that sketch.
And finally, number five. Do you have something for number five?
Do you have something for number five?
I do. My number five is Graham Chapman turning the record player on the Nazi applause. It reminds me of kind of like concerts that I go to or like spoken word. People get up in front of an audience performance, which is objectively bad. But the moderator has to get up and like, hey, look at how great this person is. All the talent up here. Oh, you can just feel it. It's just a bunch of BS and they're terrible. Graham Chapman is like, see, look at how many people are applauding here. Yeah, look around.
I agree.
This episode of The Python Perspective was conceived, researched, performed, edited, and recorded by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. Sound design also by the two of us.
Our logo was designed by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and was sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community.
You can find us at pythonperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at PythonPod. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the comic phenomenon known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
There are things, dates, facts, names, bow whales, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website and we'll post it to our errata page on pythonperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, Our discussion is not about the Wood Party, but is in fact in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Nathan. My co-host is Ben.
No, no.
We'll see you next time when we discuss episode 13, Intermission.
There will now be a medium-sized intermission.
It accentuates just how pitiful it is.
My God, this is terrible. Will somebody please stop it?
Watney's Red Barrel time.